Hey everybody, let me remind you one more time about my new blueprint for success. It's a project I've spent months and months working on just to help you jumpstart your comedy career and beat the competition. Whether you want to do stand-up, sketch, improv, acting, writing, producing, directing, radio, social media influencing, or even if you want a career behind the scenes as a manager or agent, Blueprint for Success will give you all the tools you need to take your career to the highest levels. With exclusive interviews, my top 50 commercial-free episodes from industry standard, one-on-one coaching with me, and unprecedented access into my knowledge and experience from over 40 years in this crazy business. I guarantee you that with Blueprint for Success, you'll become the creator you've always dreamed of becoming. No one's asking me to do this. I want to do it because I want to help you become truly undeniable. So just go to BarryKatz.com, click on Blueprint for Success, and start your incredible journey today. I truly can't wait to work with you to help you change the trajectory of your comedy career forever.
You have to get on the inside. You have to meet the players. You have to be part of the system. I never was an agent, but I regret it. I think I would have been a good agent, but I didn't want to do it. But it's a good thing to do.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Industry Standard with me, Barry Katz. Hope you're well, hope you're doing okay, and I'm very grateful that you're here. Thanks for supporting this project, and I hope it helps you in many different ways, or maybe it's just entertaining and just gives you a little bit of insight into this crazy, messed up business. But I love it. I love your response. I love how supportive you are. And I truly am extremely grateful. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And if you need to reach me, you can do so at Barry Katz at Instagram or Twitter, or on my website at BarryKatz.com. Or if you want to see these podcast interviews actually live and in the person, well, And if you want to see these podcasts in video format, you can go to my YouTube channel and subscribe, and love to see you there, and you can watch them. And if you don't like what you see with me, you can put a post-it note over my face and just listen to the guest. It's perfectly acceptable. You'll be happy. I won't know. It's all good. But without further ado, I want to introduce somebody I'm really excited about today, but tell you a little bit about them first in a unique way. And I'm talking about Carol Baum. And Carol, I've known for probably over 20 years. And she's a really, really special individual because she's one of those people who discovers things before most anybody discovers them. She identifies greatness before the masses identify it, and she fights for greatness to get it out to the world. She has done this on so many occasions, it's not even seemingly possible. So many different projects, so many different groundbreaking and impactful projects that have changed people's lives after they've seen them. I'm talking about The Shining. I'm talking about Dead Ringers. I'm talking about An Officer and a Gentleman. I'm talking about The Dead Zone. And so many more things that I can't even begin to mention here, or else it'd take up the whole time of the entire podcast. But what Carol's always specialized in is that that period of time when you find something that you believe in, your gut instinct tells you that it's going to be something special, and you believe in it with all your heart and you fight for it. And that's what she's done on so many different occasions to get so many different projects and movies made in a way that showcase the talents of the directors, the writers, the producers. And that's what makes her special. I always say to anyone that will listen, throughout my life, I've only gotten paid for one thing, when you really break it down. And that's my fucking opinion. And if you really believe in what you believe in and fight for what you believe in and then follow it through to where it becomes something extraordinary and really special. And if you have the ability to believe in your gut instinct, to identify things in your life that mean something to you, that blow you away, that make you feel excited and inspired, and then you follow through and you fight for them and whatever it is in your life, and you move that rock up the hill and you push it all the way to the top, and instead of letting it fall down to the bottom again like Sisyphus had to endure in Greek mythology, you find a way to keep it up on that hill for everyone to see it and everyone to know that you believed in it and the world proved that you were correct in your assessment of the content and what your instincts told you. And if you can figure out a way to do that, I can guarantee you, you'll have the kind of career that Carol Baum has.
Here we go in 3, 2.
This show will have laughter.
I got everybody pregnant with Barry Katz and semen.
I'm not comfortable with the tone this is taking.
If you're undeniable, you will not be denied.
If you want to be successful in show business, you get yourself a Jew white manager like Barry Katz.
Being a manager is just turning no's into yeses.
Creating holy shit moments.
Undeniable.
You f***ing firing me up, Katz.
I love this man.
Is there anything else I should know?
You're on.
What?
Half on the air!
Barry Katz.
Back in the house.
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 Let's do this.
All right. Without further ado, let me introduce our guest today. I'm very, very excited. You're going to really, really gain a lot of knowledge from this person. Legendary. Just incredible. All right. Carol Baum is an American movie producer best known for her work as co-president of Sandollar Productions, Dolly Parton's production company, alongside the iconic Sandy Gallen, Parton's former manager and producer. Over the course of her illustrious career, Baum rose from a publishing position at Bantam Books and Random House to co-president at Sandollar in what seemed like a short period of time, where she produced classic films such as Kicking and Screaming and award-winning documentaries such as Common Threads. In total, Baum has produced 34 movies, 17 of them independently. A New Jersey native, Baum is a graduate of Columbia High School in South Orange and New York University, where she majored in sociology. Shortly after graduating from NYU, Baum worked in publishing in New York City, and her first film job was at Palomar Pictures in New York, where she developed Ira Levin's Stepford Wives. And while at the producer circle, she developed another one of his projects, The Boys from Brazil. After relocating to Los Angeles in the early 80s, Baum quickly rose to the height of the film industry as studio vice president at 20th Century Fox and Lorimar. At this time, she developed Taylor Hackford's An Officer and a Gentleman, as well as two films directed by David Cronenberg, The Dead Zone and Dead Ringers, the latter which she used her own money to fund. Baum was the co-president of Sand Dollar Productions for 10 years, where she produced hits such as Father of the Bride, Tidy Endings, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Kicking and Screaming. Following her time at Sand Dollar, Baum headed the production of a number of independent films beginning in the late 90s, including The Good Girl, My First Mister, You Kill Me, and Boy Choir. She also moved into Hallmark movie production, and she has released 5 television movies for Hallmark since. Most recently, Baum has been working on the 2nd film in the Family History Mysteries franchise, the first of which was released in 2023. She has also been developing a TV series about the life of Greta Garbo. Presently, Baum teaches producing at the USC School of Cinematic Arts. Recently, she wrote a how-to book with her husband, Tom, based on her 10 years of teaching at USC, entitled Creative Producing, A Pitch-to-Picture Guide to Movie Development. Before this, she taught producing to grad students at the American Film Institute Conservatory and mentored at the Peter Stark Producing Program at USC. But one of my favorite credits of Carol's is the fact that she discovered the original manuscript of Stephen King's The Shining. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my guest today. What an honor. Carol Baum.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor and pleasure and privilege to introduce one of the most legendary producers I've ever had the pleasure of working with. Please welcome Carol Baum.
Thank you.
I pronounced it properly.
You pronounced it properly.
I'm doing okay. I got a little nervous there.
It's spelled
at the end.
Like B-O-W-N, but it's Baum.
Got it.
And it's my husband's name. It's not even my name.
What is your maiden name?
My maiden name is Friedland, and nobody got that right. It would be Friedlander or Freudlander. I never liked it. So when I married Tom Baum, I was happy to be Carol Baum.
And you've been married for 50 years.
60.
60 years.
Yeah.
60
But now everybody
years.
Knows how old I am. So we kind of keep that on the down low. I married my high school sweetheart. We went to public high school in New Jersey. And he was actually out of high school. He's 2 years older than me. And he wouldn't let me alone. And you know, nobody had older boyfriends at Columbia High School, South Orange, New Jersey.
What was the age difference?
2.
Okay.
But that's a big deal.
And you met him when you were a freshman?
I was a senior and he was in college.
Oh, okay.
So I had a college boyfriend and that was like a very big deal. And
so as my mother would say, you were fast.
Well, no, actually, because in those days in the 50s, fast was not us. We nice Jewish girls were, you know, but you were geared to marry. That's how we were geared, not to be a producer, not to be a businesswoman, not to do any work at all. The women in that town did not work. It was a strange thing.
It takes a really strong woman to keep the train on the tracks in a relationship for 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 60 years to keep the relationship on the track and keep love alive. Because men, we're like furniture. We don't know what we're doing. You just move us in the side of the room. You know, we don't have any concept of anything. Women keep the relationship going.
Well, I think my husband would agree with that. I got lucky. We both got lucky. We started in the same place creatively. He was a novelist, and I was not doing anything yet. But as soon as I had some ambition, it was in publishing, so we started in the same place and kept growing together. And I think that's a big deal. But it's also helpful to know our references are still Columbia High School references. Remember that one? She was just like that one, you know? It's very American Graffiti, our town. People driving cars and, you know, very squeaky clean.
I knew you grew up on the East Coast. I don't know what the socioeconomic dynamic was of your family. And I don't know what was your inspiration from getting there into this crazy effed up business. So could you let us know what that's about?
Well, I was a movie lover from age five. My grandmother, my nice Jewish Russian grandmother, took me to the movies at the Castle Theater. We knew the manager, so we got in for free. And we would see Betty Grable movies. I bet you don't even know who that is.
Of course I do.
Well, you have to be a certain age to know
Betty
Grable. I
also have done my research on you, Carol, and I know the movie that inspired you the most was The Fountainhead.
The Fountainhead, that's true. Betty Grable was the first. And I would say to my grandmother, I want a spinning skirt like Betty Grable has. And my grandmother did her best to get that
for
me.
And your grandmother said she's not a nice Jewish girl.
No, that's right. She probably did. But so that was like magic. And then what happened is I used to babysit to make extra money. Not extra money, to make money, period. And every Saturday night I would babysit for Marcia Manowitz down the street. And when Marcia went to bed, I turned on the television and I watched a movie. And The Fountainhead was one of the early movies, and to me, that was transporting. It's with Gary Cooper and Patricia Neal, and it's based on an Ayn Rand book, and it's about an architect who's got a lot of dignity and a lot of integrity, and he won't sell out. And I thought, what's that sellout stuff? And she thinks he'll be destroyed by commerce. So that's what it's about. It's a serious movie with serious themes. But the love story is magic.
Incredible.
It's magic.
You know, this woman who's wildly wealthy and this guy who's working in the quarries just, you know, without a shirt on.
You saw it too.
Of course. And he was wildly talented and he had a chance to leave that quarry and have his stuff, his architecture out there. But somebody says something to the effect of, hey, put this column here, do this here. And it's like, hey. You know, you do your thing, I'll do mine, I'll go back to the quarry.
Exactly, and I think I set my values on that movie because I have learned you have to compromise in the movie business, of course, and it's a collaborative business, but that's a good message. You know, you don't have to do what you don't want to do. You fight for the material, and I've always been a fighter from day one. That's what I do, I fight.
I always think to myself about, first of all, just to let you know, the Patricia Neal that I was introduced to for the first time was the mother in the television movie The Waltons.
Aw, well, you know, but she was gorgeous in her youth.
Yeah.
And then she had the older women parts, and she was married to Roald Dahl. You know, she had an interesting life.
Yeah.
He wasn't such a good guy.
So I've heard. But I wasn't there.
I wasn't either.
I have a lot of things to ask you about the compromises. And I think about a story I once heard. And again, you never know if these stories are factually. My mom always told me, as you know, there's your side, their side, and there's the truth. But when Vince Vaughn was doing a movie called The Breakup with Jennifer Aniston, I believe it was. And they had the end of the movie as more of a, you know, loving end to the movie where they sort of get back together again, or there's a wink, wink that we're going to get back together again. But Vince fought to have the ending like real life, where you just see each other in public and instead of getting together, you just go your own way. And I remember talking to one movie executive that worked on the movie, and he said that decision probably cost the movie $50 or $100 million at the box office. Are there decisions after your movies are made where you're fighting for something to happen and they say, no, we want it this way, and you can actually look at it, or the people actually sit around with a truth serum in their veins, even the ones who made the wrong decision, and say, we should have put this scene in this way and not done that?
Well, the famous one I wasn't involved in, it is Fatal Attraction. Because in Fatal Attraction, she is killed, forget how, but Michael Douglas kills her
in the bathtub.
In the bathtub in the reshot version of it. And I think Sherry Lansing, who was the executive, would say, it would have cost us whatever.
And I remember one thing about my movie going experience, that it's the first time it ever happened in my life where I'm sitting watching a movie and I have to get up and I am just pacing in the back of the theater because I cannot. This is too much of a thriller for me.
It was nervous making. Absolutely. You know, I've been watching Breaking Bad for some reason. I didn't watch it in its first incarnation and I'm watching it now. And I sometimes have to do the same thing. I have to get up and leave the room. It's too tense. I mean, I'm on the fourth season and it's fantastic, but it's really tense. And I'm not sure I like that all the time, especially before bedtime. But for me, it's not been reshoots. It's what happens up front. It's what happens when you're arguing about cast. That's the big one, because everybody knows cast, right? Everybody knows wardrobe, everybody knows how to dress, everybody knows hair, and everybody knows actors. And where you argue and fight is with those choices. And sometimes you lose. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose.
I remember Mario Casar told me, I interviewed him, and he produced Fatal Attraction, and he told me that he was supposed to... The agent gave him the script for Fatal Attraction and said, here, I'm going to give you a first choice of this. You can option it. You can have it. He says, I'm flying to London. I'll read it on the plane. And he lands in London and he calls the agent. He says, I love it. I'll take it. He says, I have a few other offers now. He's like, what do you mean you have a few other offers? Yeah, I have a few other offers. And, well, I offered you $250,000. That's a lot for a movie. I mean, that's, you know. Yeah, I'm thinking more like $2.5 million that you're going to have to give me.
Really?
He's like, you told me I had the movie.
Right.
He said, hey, you know,
things change.
And he paid him the $2.5 million because Mario's philosophy was, no matter how much anybody upset you, overpay and you'll get it back. Just outbid everybody and overpay. And that was always his philosophy.
Well, if you really believe in it. I mean, my big story, I guess, is The Shining, the Stephen King. Stephen King didn't like the movie. And, you know, it's Stanley Kubrick versus Stephen King. And that was big news. That made the papers that Stephen King objected to the Stanley Kubrick version. So much so, he went public about it and then he did his own version. He did a television version of The Shining, which was completely different from the Kubrick version. And you could argue, I love Stanley Kubrick. I love his version. I love Stephen King. I love his version. But that's where the arguments are. Who do you fight for? And Stephen King's script was very, very long. He wanted to include everything from the book. And the book was, you know, many, many, many hundreds of pages, and you can't do that. An experienced screenwriter will know what to pick and choose.
How did you know? Because that was one of the, I want our audience to know that was one of your, like, that was when you were reading books and you were, like, before you even had a real job in the film business.
Well, it was publishing. I did have a job in the film business early on, and that was a tiny company called the Producer Circle. But my job in New York was to find manuscripts before they were published and decide whether they were going to be movies. That was my job.
So you're reading this Stephen King thing. It's like Atlas Shrugged. It's like a huge, there's so much detail. And how could you possibly see through all that and know that that was going to be something extraordinary?
Because when you can't stop turning the pages, you know. You know, reading certain books, I remember when I was scouting book material to be made into movies, reading a book like Rosemary's Baby or Carrie, the earlier Stephen King book, or The Stepford Wives. Those books were page turners, you know, and that's my definition. How do you know? You can't stop reading them. That's my definition of a script, too. I mean, there are many more facets that go into all of it. But I remember a big producer once said to me, well, first you got to get through it. And I think that's true. You know, books that you can't get through because they're too literary or they just don't have a good plot, those don't necessarily make the best movies. And we learn this time and time again.
Tell me a movie script that you read or a book you read and you said to yourself, ugh, this is, somebody should tell this person not to quit their day job. And then it became something extraordinary and you were like, wow, I guess I missed on that one.
You know, I don't remember which ones that I didn't like that became bestsellers, because I really was in the bestseller business.
Or a movie. That became...
But I was involved with a movie called Snow Falling on Cedars. And that was what was called a literary book. The qualities were in the writing and in the milieu, but it wasn't a page turner. And it got bought by Universal to be made into a movie with Ethan Hawke, and nobody came. And that was upsetting because I really thought the book was terrific, but it was not Jaws. You know, we did define them. We'd say this is a commercial piece of fiction and this is a literary piece of fiction. And you know the difference. It's pretty clear when you read these things what the difference is. At least it was clear to me, and that was my job. Tell me a job description.
Tell me a movie you finished, and you go to the screening. Maybe you're alone at the first few screenings, and you're like, ouch. I don't know what happened here. I believed in this movie. Everything's great, and this is...
I have a lot of those, unfortunately. I have too many of those.
This is not good, but the further part of this is, and then it did really well, even though you thought it didn't turn out well. Never happened?
Never happened. The ones that I didn't think worked, didn't work.
Really? So you've never...
I wish that did
you've
happen.
You've never...
Been surprised? No. No, I think...
And you've never had an opinion on something that was contrary to somebody else, and that... I'll give you an example for our audience as well. I think it's fascinating. When I interviewed Tom Werner from Carsey Werner, he told me that they were executives at ABC, and the first project they went out with was The Cosby Show. And naturally, they go to ABC. It's where they came from. They offer them The Cosby Show, and ABC passes. NBC does The Cosby Show. It takes them from fourth to first. It's the biggest thing. The next thing that they rally around, the next thing is Roseanne. Naturally, they have a relationship with NBC that's going well. They brought them from fourth to first. They go to NBC. NBC says, we don't see it in Roseanne. Then they go to ABC. They're like, we're not going to make the same mistake we made with Cosby. We'll do Roseanne. And that goes to number one. So it happens all the time, but it doesn't happen in your career?
No. I have been involved with movies that flopped, but I knew that they were going to flop. But I've gone out with material that I believed in that the town didn't believe in. I went out with Back to the Future when it was just a script. And everybody passed. Why did they? And it was a great script. Why did they pass? Because they thought the relationship of the boy and his mother was creepy. And they weren't getting the magic of that script. So I think that's happened to me more, where I've identified something that I thought was amazing, and the town, for whatever reason, people pass on a lot of stuff. Frank Price passed on E.T. You know, everybody's got one of those.
But doesn't it bother you when they... It always bothered me, like, when I go out with something and they pass, and then 4, 5, 6 years, 3 years later, then somebody takes it out again, and then it sells.
It happens. I mean, I went out with a project called... It was called Twins at the time, but it's called Dead Ringers now, David Cronenberg's movie.
I love that movie, and I also know that you did something that the late Bernie Brillstein told me that you should never do as a producer.
Hey, everybody. I hope you're enjoying this episode as much as I am. If you made it this far and you haven't fallen asleep yet, then you must be the type of person who's serious about having a career in the comedy business. That's why I'm offering you my Blueprint for Success, a one-of-a-kind all-access pass into my knowledge and experience after over 40 years of working with the best of the best in this crazy entertainment industry. I'll tell you all the stories, all the philosophies, give you all the great special guests, and even give you one-on-one private consultations to help you expand, enhance, and skyrocket your comedy career. Just go to BarryKatz.com and click on Blueprint for Success to learn more about my groundbreaking digital academy that I've created just for you. With it, we can take your career so far that one day, instead of listening to this podcast, you'll be interviewed on it.
Put down my own money.
You put down your own money.
It's true. It's true because I read this story on the front page of the New York Times about these twin gynecologists, just for people to, who don't know this story. Front page of the New York Times, handsome Park Avenue gynecologist found dead in their apartment. Nobody knows why. So it's a mystery. It's a glamorous story about two handsome guys who were very close and had an enormous practice. And I said to myself, and I was nowhere at the time, I said, I think there's a movie here, because I always thought that way. And I was playing poker at the time. This is back in the 60s, I guess.
Did you play poker with the women?
Mixed poker game. I'd like to do it now. And at that table was a young writer named Barry Wood, who was writing a novel based on this story. And I said, Barry, you know, is anybody interested in your novel? And she said, not yet. And I said, I would like to option it with my own money. And she said, okay. She didn't have to say okay, but we were poker partners. She trusted me. And I put down money. I never did it again. But that's why I have that chain of title on that piece. And it evolved over 10 years. It took 10 years for it to get made. Because that's not the kind of movie that people are lining up for. You know, it's an art movie. And it could have gone many different ways.
They're not lining up for the gynecologist thriller movie.
But, you know, now David Cronenberg is considered an artist. And then he was just an unknown horror guy. So that's the fun part of what I do. Discovering somebody who people aren't into yet. And I knew that he was talented, and I knew that he might be a match for that particular project, and he was. But 10 years it took for anybody else to understand that that was right.
But I love what you said there, because in your career, there was a time when two people discovered you and believed in you when they were bigger than you. Which was Sandy Gallen and Dolly Parton.
Well, you know, I got that job, but I had many jobs before Sandy hired me. I was a studio executive at Fox and Lorimar. I had discovered The Shining. I worked for John Peters. I had a lot of jobs. So by the time Sandy discovered me, he didn't really. You know, I had already...
He just said he discovered
me. He just said he did. I had a reputation. I was put up for the job by CAA, so I had the backing of, you know, the important agency. And then Sandy interviewed me, but he wasn't a movie guy. So he didn't ask any of the normal questions that a person asks is, what have you read? What do you like? What's your taste like? This is Sandy's question. It's in my book. What stars do you know? Because that was Sandy's world. Movie stars. Big music stars. You know, Sandy.
Well, he also... If I could put my manager hat on, there was a little part in the back of his brain that said, maybe one of those people that she knows will be unhappy and they'll want me to manage them.
But Sandy signed people who were big. You know, that was his thing.
Well, you knew big people.
But he, you know, Dolly, Whoopi Goldberg, Mac Davis, the Pointer Sisters, they were all very successful. Neil Diamond. Very successful people. And sometimes we would bring in somebody we considered a comer. He was less interested in that. He liked them when they were...
He didn't big. Like building stars.
Well, he did and he didn't. I think he liked it better when they were stars. And that's he was good at it.
That's what's so surprising about, you know, when I follow his career and I follow what happened with Sandollar, Sandy Gallen, Dolly Parton, Sandollar. They had the logo of the little sand dollar fish, I believe.
Yes, correct.
See, I do my research, Carol.
Yeah, I'm amazed.
So am I, actually. I think about making movies is like the antithesis of what he was doing, because you make movies and you're building little stars from like a little germ of something into something big, and sometimes the kernel doesn't pop, and sometimes it does. So he was excited about that part of the business with Dolly, but diametrically opposite than signing big stars who already are making money.
You're absolutely right. I think the movie part of it sometimes frustrated Sandy, because he wanted every movie to be a home run. That was his word. And it can't be. You know, you do little movies, you do medium movies, you do movies that make it. You can't know. And development, which is what I do, was not in his world. He just didn't like the years it took, you know. But he believed in me, and I did give him Father of the Bride, and I think we got along, and I had a great relationship with Dolly. And the company was, you know, we went from studio to studio to studio, because that's what happens in those days. You'd get a two-year deal at Universal and then a two-year deal at Fox, and each time you have to prove yourself all over again.
I think after Father of the Bride, don't you think you had to fight for another two-year deal after that?
No, you do. You always have to fight. I think those deals are finite. And, you know, we were at Disney with Father of the Bride. Jeffrey Katzenberg, this is amazing to me still, Jeffrey Katzenberg greenlit 5 Sand Dollar movies that year, 1 year. Can you imagine? But they were Jeffrey's kind of movies. They were what he called singles and doubles. So they were smaller budget movies with not gigantic stars. I think Father of the Bride, of all those 5, was the biggest one, because it was got Steve Martin, but it didn't start that way. And Jeffrey was a great executive, because he said yes. He wasn't afraid to greenlight stuff. And so many people equivocated, so it was such a relief to be with him.
I remember meeting him for the first time in his office and thinking to myself, I grew up in a house that was smaller than this office.
Wasn't always like that, though.
The walk from his desk to the couches was like a 100-yard dash amount of time. I was like, I'll never forget that as long as I live. It was the first office I ever went in where I was like, I really, truly grew up in a home that was smaller than this.
Jeffrey paid his dues like anybody else. I remember meeting him in New York early on when he was in politics, I think. He wanted to be, I don't know, in politics. But he was, you could tell, you know, he had that gift. And he sure was a good executive. I miss that kind of decisiveness that you don't, you know, you give projects to people. Sometimes you hear back, sometimes you don't. And that should never happen. Jeffrey trained everybody who worked for him. You make the Monday call, you pass, you move on. Don't keep people waiting. Those are very good philosophical ideas.
I always think when I'm pitching things, I think I don't know, I just find it so comical. It could be the same exact studio or network, and they might tell you Monday no or yes, or it's the same studio. You could wait 3 months, and it's like, you know, could I get a yes? Could I get a no? So it's like it doesn't seem like there's a system of how you notify
people. Well, there isn't now, but I think there used to be a better system. But the agents all complain now, and they say, oh, fell down the black hole, you know, and they're sending works of people we've heard of, and they don't hear back. What's the problem? It's so easy to just type out a little email. Not for me. It's all you have to do. Don't keep people waiting. I have a lot of chapters in my book about that, because I really believe that you've got to respect people who've written the damn thing and are taking it around and believe in it. And I think it's important.
Tell our audience, in the early days, when you had to fight for what you believed in, but there was a almost a battle of the sexes kind of culture where women were being kept down, many would argue still being kept down. How did you fight hard to make your point and get what you wanted in what maybe you might consider at the time a man's world in show business?
Well, when I came out to Hollywood, it was a man's world, and I was one of the few women with children and a marriage that I was keeping together with these little kids, and I was the only one. It's no fun to be the only one, but I was, and I remember going up for certain jobs that I lost to men, and I never found out why. Maybe they were more qualified, maybe they weren't, but they were men, and I didn't get certain jobs. But I got a lot of other jobs because I was the person who had a reputation for knowing material. And that was my thing. It's still my thing. I know how to read something and say, you know something, I think this has possibilities. We'll get cast for this. We'll get a good director for this. And so that is not either a man or woman thing. You know, women are often the readers and the note takers. And that's what I was and still am. I was going to title my book The Oldest Living D-Girl, but everybody said, you can't say that. But that's kind of how I feel, is like I'm still doing it the same way that I've always done it. You read something, you champion it, you become an advocate, and then somebody listens because you're the cheerleader. Well, you know better than anybody about being a cheerleader. It's what we do.
I feel like when I go on a set, one of the first things I like to do, and people always look at me like I'm a mental patient, is that I always get the stars coffee and whatever they want. I always walk right up, what can I get you? I'm like, Barry, chill out. You're just, you know, you're not getting me coffee. Yeah, no, let me get what you want. Because I never want to lose sight of that, the lowest job there is.
You know what, that's great. Honestly, that's great. Because there is something that happens to people. They get a little uppity sometimes, and they lose sight of what counts. Certainly that happens in Hollywood a lot. And I feel, and the reason I wrote a book is that I felt I never got rid of my New Jersey roots. That is who I am. It's just what you're saying. Came out from New Jersey, a shy girl with no, I wasn't Howard Roseman, you know, I wasn't a performer. And I did it because I loved it. I loved the movies.
Let's talk about, because you've made, I believe, 35 movies. If all of them were drowning in the ocean, and you only save one that you could put in a time capsule, and people open it up 100 years from now, and it has your name on it, and you want to be remembered for the kind of direction, production quality, acting performances, and story.
That's a hard one, because I have a couple of pets. We've already talked about Dead Ringers. That would have been one of them. But since we talked about that, I'm not going to mention that one. But there's another one. It's called The Good Girl.
Of course.
And it's with Jennifer Aniston and Mike White, who is now the reigning genius because of White Lotus, wrote that on spec. Nobody knew him. He had been on Dawson's Creek. I think that was his series. But he was an up-and-coming young writer. And I read that script, that spec, and I thought it was sensational. And I thought, nobody's going to like see this right away. It's very quirky. It's very weird. It's very Mike White. And Mike was attached as director for a number of years until he said, finally, I'm moving on.
Now, I don't know you as well as you know you. But I do know that when you're putting a project together, your goal is to, if I may say so, put as many lottery balls in that clear round hopper as possible, so your movie gets made and it's successful. And I'll tell you, one of the ways to take the balls out of the hopper as quickly as possible is to allow the first-time writer to have the director credit. but you allowed that and you supported that. Why?
I recognized something special in Mike White. He was like nobody else. I didn't know he was going to do White Lotus, but I'm not surprised. And he was so unique. He was an individual. There was nobody like him. He grew up in Pasadena. He was singular. And that's why I just believed in him. And I think when that happens, and it happens a lot to me in early in my career, I would meet with the writer, director, whoever it was, and there was some instinct. You know this because you interview performers all the time. A writer, director, whoever it is, can walk into your office and right away, it's not about the connection you make necessarily, but there's something about them, their level of confidence and self-belief and how they talk. And they don't have to be selling, but it is a certain confidence. Mike had it. He definitely had it. And I found a letter, because we're showing The Good Girl at a screening in a few weeks because I'm trying to sell my book. And I found a letter from his father, Mel White, who was trying to help us get financing for the movie. And nobody wanted to do this movie. You know, it's a very peculiar movie. And we had a cast that was not Jennifer Aniston. It was somebody else, but I think I'd better not say who it was. A star, though. And the letter from Mike to his friend, a financier, was, my son has written this script, and he's currently on Dawson's Creek, and he's this and he's that. And I think when you read this script, you will see, basically he said the same things that I'm just saying. You will see a singularity in this. He happens to be my son, and I dig him, but you will see something special in this. And that specialness is what we all look for. It's hard to find it, but Mike had it. He really had it and has it. And everything that he did after The Good Girl shows it. You know, his stuff is all really deeply original.
Amazing. So I'm going to talk a little bit about your book in and out here, but the major theme of the book, obviously, is you're trying to help people not make the same mistakes that you might have made in the beginning, not go through the same crap that you went through. And then when they do go through the same stuff that you went through, that they have systems to how to solve each one of the problems. So obviously this book is very comprehensive, but are there certain like commandments of producing that are the most important things to always remember to be successful? And if so, what are they?
Well, the main one is we've discussed already, be an advocate. Be an advocate, be an advocate, and people will listen to you when you're strong about your opinion. They really will, because a lot of people don't have opinions. They're waiting to see what's hot. What's everybody talking about?
You know, it's interesting. That's the only thing I've ever been paid for in my life.
What?
It's my opinion.
Okay, there you go.
I mean, I never get any money for anything else.
So you know what I'm talking about. But being an advocate, and I think I talk about this a lot in the book, so that's one thing I really believe in. Don't be afraid to call anybody. Another title of the book was going to be I'll Call Anyone, because when nobody knows who you are, how are they going to know who you are? You have to figure out a way, and I think meeting assistants is the best way, or getting a job inside an agency and learn the ropes and get all those contacts or go to film school. You can't just do it off the street. I think it's very hard to do that. I had jobs, job after job after job, which introduced me to the community. Each time I met more people, I networked. And I wasn't a natural networker because I was home with my family. So I didn't go to... I got fired once by the head of Fox.
I wanted to talk to you about that, but I'm glad you brought it up.
Well, I was fired because I didn't go out every night to Le Dome and the Ivy. And the restaurants were named to me by the head of the company. He says, if I see Don Steele there every night, and where are you? You're not there. And I said, well, first of all, my writers don't want to put on a tie and go to those places anyway. and I have a family. And I he said to me, find other writers. That was the answer, which is sort of a funny thing to say, and that's why I put it in the book. But I got fired. I got fired because I didn't play the game. And I play the game in my way, but because I do stuff, I do a lot of stuff, but I wasn't willing to do that.
But this is what's interesting, and this is for the audience, you should know this, and Carol might disagree with me. If you're a young artist, and it's hard for me to talk about because I consider Carol an artist, even though I know she knows she's an artist, but technically speaking, in a court of law, she's a producer. But she's a creative producer. But the point I'm trying to make is if you're a comedian or a magician or a torch singer or whatever it is, you have to stay hard and fast on your lane, and you have to really, really, you have to don't play the game, play your game, let them find you, let them chase you like your ass is on fire. As a young producer, you have to play the game. You don't play the game, somebody else is going to play the game better and they're going to get in. And so it's a different kind of artist where you have to do a little tap dancing, do a little shuck and jiving, do a lot of things that you don't want to do to get your movie made. Whereas if you're Bert Kreischer, you start your podcast and you talk to your fans and you say fuck you to every television executive that didn't hire you. And that's the way it is. Or Joe Rogan or any of these people who made their own way and figured out how to do it without, you know, I don't know. Comedians are modern day philosophers, so I don't think a lot of them who have their own money and figure out their own concert fans, I don't think they ultimately can ever get canceled. You know, I think, you know, Chris D'Elia is still doing dates. Dave Chappelle, you know, just got caught in a controversial thing where he talked about Israel, you know, and the Palestinians on a Boston Garden show, and which was probably really challenging for him, really challenging for the fans. Some comedians don't agree with Michael Jordan when he says, I'm not going to talk politics, even Republicans buy sneakers. But the point I'm trying to make is that even though you're an artist, you have to bend. You're like Gumby. And you have to go through all these things and have all these cooks in the kitchen, whereas a regular artist doesn't. How do you get your way when there's so many cooks in the kitchen? How do you get what you want? How do you navigate? Is that something that you talk about?
Well, I think what you said is a great definition of an artist, and I don't think of myself that way. I am not a performer.
I know you think of yourself as an artist.
I don't. No, I really don't. I'm a facilitator. I'm an editor. I work with the artists, and I become their best friend. But I think what I
do... Well, I always felt you were an artist.
Well, I appreciate that. My husband will laugh. I think what I do, and this is what people say to me, oh, you have such good taste. And that's my reputation. So it's my taste that sees me through. For some reason, well, and not some reason, I've produced a lot of movies, but they're all different. And this book has been interesting to me because people will say two things about it. Well, your taste comes through. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been able to get going what you got going. But you're a fighter. I am a fighter. I know that. I'm a very stubborn person. I really don't listen to anybody. I, you know, had a lot of difficult bosses. But I you know, made them happy, but I did my thing. And I fought for what I fought for. And I think that those two qualities are what's kept me. It's why I'm still sitting here, you know. I do believe in what I believe in, and you can't talk me out of it. If I fall in love with the good girl, I'm in love with the good girl, and nobody's can tell me otherwise. So I think there's certain projects that are like that. Not a lot, not enough. I have a lot of projects, and they all have different places in my heart, but there's some that really, you know, the other person I'm very proud to have discovered is Noah Baumbach. Well, everybody knows Noah now because of Barbie. But when Noah came out of Vassar College, where he went with my son, nobody heard of Noah Baumbach. And he had written a script called The Fifth Year, which is a very simple idea. It's about what happens when these five friends don't want to leave the campus because they don't want to be grown-ups. And they hang out at the local bar. That's it. And Noah wrote this script. It was, I guess, his first. And I fell in love with it because that's what I do. And I championed him. And he also wanted to direct it. And he really had no credentials. He was right out of college. But I felt the thing I described early, I felt it. Noah was had a certain kind of confidence and a certain kind of radiance, and I felt it.
One.
Hidden.
Dos.
Two.
Three.
Cinco.
Cuatro.
Five.
Cinco.
Six.
6 degrees of separation.
All right, 6 degrees of separation. I'm going to mention some people. Why don't you tell me what comes to mind?
Uh-oh.
Could be a sentence, could be a phrase, could be a little tiny story. Barbara Streisand.
I worked for Barbara when she before she did Yentl. And she was married to, I don't know if they ever married, John Peters at the time. And it was John Peters who hired me. And I loved Barbara. Who wouldn't love Barbara? Nice Jewish girl. You know, I completely identified with her. Not really. She's Barbara Streisand. But the Jewish thing, you know. And she, and I could talk to her in that way. And it was really a treat.
Walter Matthau.
The best. Walter Matthau, what can you say about Walter? Walter would play Mozart in his trailer. I would visit and hang out with him. He was a doll, and I just loved him to pieces.
Robert De Niro.
Didn't get friendly with him. He was a cold fish. And, well, that's not fair. He was just, as many people have observed, not the friendliest guy.
The Dead Zone.
Well, The Dead Zone I brought in when I was working at Lorimar. And my job was to find books. And David Picker was the boss. And he said, let's do this. But it didn't happen under Lorimar. I mean, it didn't. Lorimar got some interest in it, but it didn't happen. I had no involvement in it, sadly. I tried. Couldn't do it.
An officer and a gentleman.
That was my big discovery when I worked for David Picker. I found the script, spec, loved it. Nobody wanted it. That's a good example of a script where everybody passed, everybody in town, and everybody said to me, well, why would you want to get involved with this dead script that nobody likes? And I said, because I think it's great, and trust me, let's see what happens. And it happened, and it was a gigantic hit, you know?
Greta Garbo.
Well, that's in development. Greta Garbo is a very difficult project to get made. Maybe you've got some good ideas because it's period. And television people don't like period. And Greta Garbo is a period actress. But we are committed to it. And I have to find the right actress to make that happen, which I'm going to do one day, I hope.
Jennifer Aniston.
Jennifer did The Good Girl. And it was, you know, amazing. And she was off of Friends earning, you know, a ton of money every week for Friends. But she was ready to make a change, and her boyfriend, Brad Pitt, was responsible for her doing the movie, I believe. I don't know if she would admit that, but he was behind it because he was a fan of the project. He was a fan of Miguel Arteta, who directed it, and he liked it for Jennifer, and he was right.
Kicking and Screaming.
That's Noah Baumbach's first film. Kicking, my version of Kicking and Screaming, not the Will Ferrell version. It was called The Fifth Year, became Kicking and Screaming, Noah's first, his debut film.
Steve Martin.
Well, Steve Martin is a giant. You know, Steve Martin did Father of the Bride, and who could have done it better? He was fantastic.
Awards.
You know, I guess some of my projects have been nominated. I don't pay too much attention to it, honestly. It's nice when it happens, but I, you know, I don't know. Can't even remember.
Boys from Brazil.
That that was a project. I found a book when I was working for the producer circle that I championed, and they bought, and it became a movie with Gregory Peck. A very successful movie.
My First Mister.
It's a little tiny movie that Christine Lottie directed. Albert Brooks starred in it. It was also from a spec that I fell in love with, a teeny weeny movie that I knew I it wouldn't get made unless I found a significant actor to be the guy. The girl was cast as Lily Sobieski when nobody knew who she was yet, but we got Albert. That was a big coup for us.
John Peters.
John Peters was a boss under the category in my book called Horrible Bosses. John was a very difficult, charismatic and brilliant in his way, but a very difficult guy. Very difficult.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Buffy was Joss Whedon's, I don't know if it's his first script, it's another one of those firsts. And Howard Roseman, to his credit, championed Buffy. Buffy, Buffy, Buffy. And Sandy didn't like Buffy because he thought we should be doing things with a little more dignity. Buffy was Buffy, you know. Look what happened.
Dolly Parton.
Well, Dolly is a treasure, and I'm thrilled that it never stops with her. I mean, Dolly's year this year is just incredible. And she was such a champion at Sandollar. She wanted to have a movie company with Sandy, her best friend, and she came to meetings, and she was a delight and a beautiful person. She was the greatest. Not was, is. She's Dolly.
Your proudest moment in show business?
Oh, I don't know. Getting these hard-to-get movies made, you know? Surviving, I think. I think I'm a survivor. Here I am telling you these stories. It's been a lot of years. I have grandchildren, still married, and I'm teaching, and I wrote a book. Here's what's really thrilling to me. I wrote this book with my husband, and people are saying, this is what they're saying. They're saying, I wish this book existed when I entered show business. I wish I knew all the things that your book, which reads like a mentorship, was around. Well, you can imagine how that makes me feel, because that was the intention, but that doesn't mean that it works.
Two more quick things.
Oh, my God.
Your biggest disappointment in show business and how you used it to fuel yourself to the next level.
I think shining through a film with stars, Melanie Griffith, Liam Neeson, Michael Douglas, was a big flop. And it was a big budget movie, biggest one I had ever been involved with, and it was not good. And it took me a while to get over that. That was a sad experience, a toxic experience. Nobody should have those.
Last question. What advice do you have for the young person growing up in New Jersey in a small town with a dollar and a dream and to have the kind of amazing, extraordinary career that you've had? How could they get there?
Come out and be a junior agent at CAA. I tell them that. They don't like to hear that. My students still think agencies are not where it's at. It is. Trust me. You know that. You have to get on the inside. You have to meet the players. You have to be part of the system. I never was an agent, but I regret it. I think I would have been a good agent, but I didn't want to do it. But it's a good thing to do.
It's fascinating that your advice is something that you didn't follow and you become extraordinarily successful.
Well, I didn't have the negotiating abilities, which you have to have as an agent, because I really don't care about money. I probably shouldn't say that out loud, but that wasn't my main motivator. But being with people and getting friendly with everybody, that suited me. And being on the inside is where you want to be.
Awesome. Carol Baum, this has been incredible. You are amazing. And I knew the moment I first met you, and one of the first films I ever got involved in was with you. And it set the tone for disappointment thereafter, because there's no one like you in the world.
Oh, you're a doll to say that. You know, I still talk to the writer of Fairhope once in a while. He'll call me. He'll check in. And it's sad to me, that story of that. We didn't talk about that, but it's sad that too difficult. Some things are too difficult.
Well, you're not difficult. Thank you so much.
Well, you are the greatest interviewer. And I lost my glasses.
I want to hear that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As always, this has been Industry Standard with me, Barry Katz. And if you like the show, tell all your friends. And if you don't like the show, tell all your friends.
All the people love you, 'cause you're going far. Life is for the dreamers, they have all to gain. It's never quite over till it all feels the same.
Thank you for listening to Industry Standard with Barry Katz. If you'd like more info on our schedule of new episodes or how to reach Barry through Twitter, Facebook, or email, go to BarryKatz.com. Before you leave, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast, leave a comment, and rate it, even if you think it blows. Thank you for your support, and have a great day.
Hey, everybody. Let me remind you one more time about my new blueprint for success. It's a project I've spent months and months working on just to help you jumpstart your comedy career and beat the competition. Whether you want to do stand-up, sketch, improv, acting, writing, producing, directing, radio, social media influencing, or even if you want a career behind the scenes as a manager or agent, Blueprint for Success will give you all the tools you need to take your career to the highest levels. With exclusive interviews, my top 50 commercial-free episodes from Industry Standard, one-on-one coaching with me, and unprecedented access into my knowledge and experience from over 40 years in this crazy business. I guarantee you that with Blueprint for Success, you'll become the creator you've always dreamed of becoming. No one's asking me to do this. I want to do it because I want to help you become truly undeniable. So just go to BarryKatz.com, click on Blueprint for Success, and start your incredible journey today. I truly can't wait to work with you to help you change the trajectory of your comedy career forever.